Logistics and being able to provide the resources you need are actually the foundation elements of your own liberty and freedom. You've got to make things. This idea that we don't have to make things is nonsense, really. We got to the point where the Americans realized that they could be attacked and they couldn't defend themselves, because the right way to think about it is the globalization's dying and it's going to be a painful death.
Craig Tindale is an Australian writer and ex-personality decoding the return of real-world constraints: energy, metals, supply chains, and industrial power.
His core message: the future will be won by those who can still make things.
These new AI data centers can use 50,000 tons of copper, and they can use, you know, 10 or 20 tons of silver. And so we haven't got enough copper, we haven't got enough lead, we haven't enough silver, we haven't got enough anything. But people won't believe.
Hey guys, don't skip this part. There's something for you to win here. We're running a 21-day sprint and giving away 3 signed copies of our Bitcoin book to listeners who help grow the show on Fountain. There are 3 ways to win. Either become the top supporter and cumulative sats zapped over this 21-day period, or provide the most Bitcoin-like zap, meaning you don't just zap big, but in style, or last but not least, create the most amount of valuable content around any episode during this 21-day period on either X or Noster. Provided you are a subscriber to the show on Fountain, have reposted the sprint post on Noster or X, and emerge as the leader in any of the categories mentioned above, you'll be the proud owner of a new Bitcoin book in no time. We'll share an update of the leaderboard on each show during the campaign. Good luck, and now on to today's show. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Joining me today is Craig Tindale out of Australia. And Craig, I've been following for quite some time. I think you've been quite a prominent ex-profile as of recently. You've written some very great articles on, I guess, everything from economic constraints, supply chain, critical resources, and had some really good takes on what's happening in the world today. So I wanted to bring you on. So cool to have you with us today.
Lovely to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes. Well, I mean, as I said, you know, I want to tackle this maybe from a very high level, you know, given that I have this expert with me, I think, who can really zoom out and tell the audience and tell us what's really happening in the world, you know, because I feel like a lot of people still cannot really wrap their head around. They're hearing it's about China, it's about trade reordering, it's about Trump wanting to make America great again and stuff like this. But then there's also a moral element to it. A lot of people are just hating on it and feel like, oh, it's a Trump thing. You know, he's trying to destroy the world. But yeah, what is the current conflict really about in your mind? And could you give us the 30,000 feet view on what's happening?
Okay. The world has changed a lot in the last decade, you know, with electrification, renewable energy, and AI now coming along. And we had a fairly light industrial demand prior to that. But these new, I guess, elements of the economy that are emerging exponentially, heavy industrial industrial metabolisms. You know, we talk about things in the cloud, but, you know, these new AI data centers can use 50,000 tons of copper, and they can use, you know, 10 or 20 tons of silver. And so what's happened out of the blue is an exponential demand factor. Now, separate to this, you know, that's the demand side. On the other side, separate to this, the West decided that they didn't want to do any dirty stuff. So they didn't want to do refining with copper. They didn't want to do silver refining. They didn't really want to do anything that made pollution. And, you know, we all know the story. Learn to code, we'll go up the value chain, and they can do all the dirty stuff. And, you know, there was a whole bunch of economic theory that came out of the 90s, economic rationalism, price efficiency, globalized trade, etc. And what we basically decided in the West that the most efficient method of managing your economy was through a system of, the Price is Right, price efficiency. If you could make an iPhone in China at half the price, you might as well make the iPhone in China. So what happened in Europe and what happened right across North America and Australia and Canada is that we decided to outsource just about everything. We decided not to make anything. We were going to do bits and bytes, and we were going to deal with the kind of the new world, and they were going to do the old world. Now, what's emerged is that, that has some downsides because, as Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton pointed out, and Eisenhower, and I guess a bunch of the wartime prime ministers right across Europe, is that logistics and being able to provide the resources you need are actually the foundation elements of your own liberty and freedom. If you're beholden to a foreign power to get your supplies of stuff, whether they be manufactured goods or whether they be refined metals like copper and silver, if you're beholden to them, they actually have a control of your economy because you can't make anything they don't agree to. And so over a period of about 20 years, the plan, I think Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said the Chinese plan was 25 years old. Well, there's truth. They, over 25 years, said, sure, we'll do all your dirty work. We'll do your 50% of the world's copper refining is now done in China, and 98% of most of the rare earths is now done in China. And most of the gases and chemicals all the things that you need to do to make stuff is made in China. And so about 2.5-3 years ago, they started licensing the purpose of these materials. And these licensing requirements became, more stricter and stricter, to the point, jumping to the present, in March, they told the Japanese they weren't going to export rare earths that could be used in defense. They told the Americans that they weren't going to export silver. They were told that they would license the end product, and if the end product didn't suit them, they would, they may choose not to supply that. So that's created a significant tension in the world because, to reverse engineer that means that Japan or the US can't defend itself if it can't acquire those goods. And you may have all the copper mines in the West. We might have all the lead and zinc and various other metal mines and lithium mines, etc. But if it's all sent to China before it goes to the West, they have the control point. So think of gamify it in your head a little bit, and you're playing this kind of sophisticated game of Risk, and you have to rely on China for everything you get, and they're going to tell you what you can get it for and what you can't get it for. And this was all the build up to China wanting to take over Taiwan. It's easy to China, you can't fight back if you haven't got the metals to make your munitions. If you haven't got the anatomy to make munitions, you just can't make them. It's that simple. And you can see a bit of it in the Ukraine war is that Russia expanded their ability to produce artillery shells by, to 4 million shells a year, and the West was struggling at 400,000. And so you've got this constraint, and it's happened before, in 1914, Germany, I might bastardize this word, but it's Metallgesellschaft, I think. It was a company in Germany that did all the refining as well, and they had American copper and they had Australian metals, and they had companies all over the world that were sending back the ore, and they were refining it, and then they were sending it to the West. So it's exactly the same scenario, and the same scenario has happened again and again in history. So it's not unusual. And, at the Battle of Orgeux in France in 1914, the French couldn't fight back because they ran out of artillery shells. They just weren't, they literally didn't work because they didn't have the right ingredients. And Lloyd George in 1915 was appointed because they called it the shell crisis. And then Lloyd George was appointed as the Minister of Munitions in 1915 to make sure that they could get munitions to fight the Germans. And that's a kind of simplistic way of explaining it, but it goes much deeper than that, because you may have a copper mine or you might have a lithium mine in Australia or Canada, but you can't, if the company that takes the offtake agreement, you know, the agreement that they will take the ore from that company, you know, is signed over to China, it can't be diverted anywhere else but China. So that's another control point. They controlled the contracts for the mines. They controlled the refining because we just didn't have it. We closed them all down. And then they went into the financing of mines that were specifically to supply China. So they were providing cheap finance. And, you know, many of the mines the Chinese had opened would never be opened by Western companies because they couldn't get an ROI, because they couldn't get what they call weighted average cost of capital at a level that would make it profitable. And there's, you know, Sinani, the new iron ore mine in Guinea is a great example. $20 billion to build an iron ore mine. You know, 10 of that was for a freight train to move the ore. And, you know, for an Australian company or an American company to build that, it would have taken 10 years to get a payback. But for the Chinese, because they buy so much iron ore, they just didn't care because it lowered the price overall. So, you know, I'm drawing a picture of a multi-level strategy by the Chinese, and let's not blame the Chinese. They're just playing their game from their side. They've got the hand that they're being given, and our economic system basically gave it to them. So they've played the cards that they have, and they've got control. So in the kind of geopolitical sense, that's panicked the Americans. Predominantly, I don't think any other countries, and that's the context to see that of what Trump's thinking about, is that, you know, we know Trump is unusual, and let's accept that, but he also has a team of advisors that I've been studying for years, and his team of advisors are highly thought out strategists. So what looks like crazy from Trump is actually, I can take back 4 or 5 years. People like Elbridge Colby, who's the grandson of one of the ex-CIA chiefs, he was writing essays on what should happen to make America more secure about this 4 or 5 years ago. And what's happening now is exactly what he wrote out. Now, there's a bunch of them. I won't go into each one of them. But he has a vanguard of military experts behind him who are guiding this type of thing. So why did Venezuela come up? How do we make sense of that from a strategic point of view? You know, with this rare earths and with this copper control they've put in place, the only way to, I guess, counterpunch or offset that or to neutralize it is to control what China needs, and China needs energy. China was getting its energy from Venezuela, was getting its energy from Iran. And so, you know, I don't attach any moral absolutism to any of this, because I think it's better to understand it first than worry about the morality of what's happening. And then we can decide on the morality after that. But if you've got a major nuclear superpower, fearful for its existential survival because it can't get the copper. You know, that literally means you can't build all these data centers. You can't build these electrification ideas that they're doing. You know, they're going to lose the AI race if they don't get these rare earths. They're not going to be able to build missiles. It panics them, and it gives them an incentive to then move up move into a different mode, and that's existential defense. So, you know, they went over to Venezuela. We know what happened there, and they got that oil. Now they're trying to balance it with Iran. If they control Hormuz, they will control China's energy. And China's doing things like coal to liquids and all kinds of things to offset that. So it's a big game of chess. And through that lens, you can kind of understand what the Americans are panicked about. And through that lens, you also can, I guess, relay some responsibility to the Chinese for putting such a thing in place and trying to control everything. Because, like, at the end of the day, those types of strategies create incentives for counter strategies, and then counter strategies on those counter strategies and everything. The Americans, you know, one of Pete Hegseth, before he became the head of the Department of War, said that, you know, aircraft carriers weren't worth much anymore because they could get sunk by hypersonic missiles. Because they're very hard to defend us against. Hypersonic missiles, by the way, aren't just ones that fly fast. The hypersonic glide missiles, you know, are put up by rockets and glide into place. They turn on, they have no engine. They have no heat signature. They're very hard to detect. And so you end up with, I guess, a legitimate concern on the American side, because they've got a situation where they can't defend themselves as well. So, you know, from a military strategy point of view, they go, well, you know, what do we have to the strengths? And they have a blue water navy that's much more significant than the Chinese navy and a few other things. But, you know, it's an equalizing thing. This is what great powers do, you know. People, I guess, have been moralizing about why there'll be a multipolar world, not realizing that what a multipolar world actually looks like in reality. And the multipolar world in reality, it doesn't look like the America that you used to have. You know, Trump will come and go. He'll be there maximum another 2 years. He's getting older. You know, same with Putin, same with Xi. They're all getting older. And what happens is there'll be a pass to a new group of leaders who have those same pressures on them, who have the existential pressures on them to make sure that they become, I guess, whole and can protect themselves. And, you know, the military strategy can be divided, you know, homeland military strategy, you protect your major country. In China's case, it's China. In the US case, it's that their homeland is the US. Then you've got rimland theory in military circles. That's the layer around the cake that is around your homeland. And for China, that's the, you know, first island chain. And for the US, it's Canada and Greenland and Mexico and Suez and all the things that we've heard them worry about. And so you've got this multipolar world is now framing into what it's going to look like. And it's going to be tougher. Now, this disconnection between these two, this the end of globalization, brings about other considerations. We've got a globalized supply chain. You know, that globalized supply chain is extremely brittle. I put out a paper yesterday that looked at the petrochemical supplies into agriculture. Now, 25% of the LNG has been cut off, and you use LNG to crack fertilizer, you know, to make urea, to make the heavy rock fertilizers, etc. You need sulfur to do that too, because in the first stage of the process, you've got all this sulfur acid leaching that has to go on. So you use sulfur to break it down. So there's two things that come out of Hormuz already. And not only do they come out of Hormuz, they come out of China, and China's decided it's not going to send any more to the West. So we've lost the Hormuz sulfur, we've lost the Chinese sulfur, and that means that a lot of this stuff can't get made. Now, on top of that, we've got herbicides and fungicides and pesticides. Now, we've got an El Nino coming. It's, you know, they talk about it, and climate scientists are not good predictors, but they're pretty sure of this one. You've got an El Nino coming now that could be as big as the one in 1877, you know, a 150-year event. Now, what happens to crops in those situations? Well, You need fertilizers to make sure the roots get down to get the lower water table. You need fertilizers to, you know, grow the leaves. You need fertilizers to, and they're different fertilizers to grow the stems. So we've got a combinational fertilizer thing. And if we run out, that's one thing. But if we also run out of rain because of El Nino, it means the fertilizer sticks on the top of the soil and actually draws the ingredients or the nutrition out of the soil onto the top because you're not washing it in. Now, if that happens and it's drier weather, the weeds get way more competitive, and the weeds start drowning out the crops. And because there was something like 40 million tons of herbicide is made in Asia. It's all shipped down through Hormuz and gets made in Malaysia and places like that. So you can't use herbicide because we're in a monocrop world, you can't grow monocrops. It's that simple. And you can't, you know, if you're in drought and you can't use your herbicides, well, then the insects come in and you haven't got the pesticides. And so you start getting this layered situation on itself. And it starts to look pretty serious.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, like from all of what I'm hearing from you, like it's just a very great picture of painting that the world is immensely complex nowadays. You know, it's always been complex. Like we humans have built a civilization which is immensely complex with all these things. And as you just explained, even just fertilizer, you know, what everything that has to kind of come and fall into parts and come together that for everything to work is just amazingly complex. And I think that's exactly one of the things that you said in the beginning, especially we in the West, we kind of take this for granted or have taken this for granted, you know. And there has been this shift in the last 25 years, you know, that you explained, this geopolitical shift. I'd frame it from like we do all the bits, you know, but then the atoms we leave to the dirty stuff, as you called it, we leave to the rest of the world. And we have really not appreciated of what this means. You know, if you kind of lose this productive capacity and all these atom things, because everything is downstream of these sorts of foundational basis layers in that sense, you know. But then my follow-up questions to kind of come back to the high-level thing maybe once more is, you know, we know this is going on. Some of, you know, you people point this out, you know, you explained it as well, that Trump has all these experts who understand this. But why couldn't this be going on? You know, like, is it just that we're steering towards a wall inevitably that we will hit sometime and then it will be even more catastrophic? Or why couldn't we go on with this sort of division of labor, you know, like or my other question, why do we take action now? Why is it Trump? Is it just like the fate, you know, that kicks in at some point, or like why couldn't we go on and just
in economics there's a thing called a long tail. So you know, the tail that comes and gets you after a long period of time that you don't necessarily foresee. And what happened is we built this system and we thought it was pretty efficient and robust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd raise and lower interest rates. And the central banks didn't notice that all the industrial economy had basically died. And so there's only so far you can take that. You can borrow money and serve cups of coffee to each other, you know, for a certain amount of period, you know, 20, 25, 30 years. You can inflate assets if you want, but at the end of the day, you know, it's like a nil-sum game eventually. You can't do it forever. You've got to make things. This idea that we don't have to make things is there with, you know, the South Sea bubble and tulips. The people who don't make things can remain free and make their own decisions is nonsense. We've got to make things. You know, we lionized Zuckerberg and Jobs and people who made devices to take our attention, and you know, there's a whole list of, and I've talked to most of them, the whole list of inventors that never got any credit for creating, you know, very unique industrial innovation, but they could never get it financed because we weren't interested in that. We're interested in our attention deficit disorder and looking at screens all the time and TikTok. And, you know, we all do it. You know, that's no judgment, but the reality is it has a consequence. And the consequence is that you can't, you know, you eventually run out of runway and you can't fly the plane anymore. You have to sit on the ground. And so what the Americans are trying to do, and, you know, I think the Americans are probably alone at the moment in trying to do it. The Japanese certainly didn't deindustrialize as much. But the Europeans certainly have. You know, I've got figures for the European economy and even the Indian economy. They decided they were going to rely on China for everything and just import things. And so, you know, where are you going to get your jobs? Where are you going to really run the economy? And that's the answer to your question. We ran out of runway. That's, you know, we got to the point where the Americans realized that they could be attacked and they couldn't defend themselves because they couldn't replace their F-35s. They couldn't, you know, McDonnell Douglas, the CEO, made a great speech about how he couldn't exist as a defense supplier without Chinese supply lines. And, he's earning $24 million a year, and you think to yourself, for $24 million a year, you couldn't work out that if you got supplied by China, you might have to fight them. And it creates incentives. Everybody tries to see it through a moral lens. It's, if you have a weakened U.S. Military, that creates incentives for the Chinese to take advantage of it. And for its rivals to take advantage. And so it's not equal.
I mean, that's a great way to frame it. You know, I think in the end, it's not so much that China will at some point be so strong that they will take over the entire world and maybe even attack the US outright. You know, that's maybe that happens. We don't know, but it's really happening at the margins, you know, and it's more subtle in the sense of that they can then start kind of exerting that force in their region, and the US can't just really do anything about it because at some point, as you said, you know, their capacity to take action is just going to be limited because China has all the control over the really foundational base metals and rare earth and everything that goes into doing actual stuff. And that's kind of the risk. And then with Europe as well, it's just that we lose, the ability to have an industry which still sort of provides jobs and stuff. And at the margin, this just nags away, you know, at the ability of just catering to your people then as well. And that's why then maybe a welfare state has to be blown out of proportion to kind of help along, and government grows. And we all know that might not be the solution in the end, you know. So that's sort of all these downstream effects of what's happening here. My question would be, like you said it as well, like US people, some of the experts do understand it. But what about other political leaders and experts, you know, in the West? Do they understand this? And you said the other risk is like if Trump is away in 2 years, there might be somebody else coming along who still wants to play this game of, yeah, we want to go back to the old system where we are the financial power and we outsource everything. And I mean, there's a real risk. This people will try to kick the can down the road because I feel like, from what I can tell, not a lot of people, even political leaders, do seem to see that risk, you know? Or are we starting to see the dominoes fall? What is your impression? Like,
I think we could go back. That's certainly a theory. And I have lots of colleagues that think that, you know, they lose the midterms and all of a sudden Trump is emancipated and you know, they try and kick him out. You know, personally, I don't think Trump is going to go to an election. I think the reality is he's probably going to hold the presidency right through to the midterms. Sorry, past the midterms to the end of his situation. You know, there's a lot of conflict going on in the U.S. system over political fairness without, you know, taking sides. You know, there's proof on both sides that, you know, something or other is going on. And, you know, Trump's trying to put through some legislation that basically says you have to be able to ID yourself before you vote. Now, you know, I'm not sure he's going to get that through, but you can't it's not hard to imagine a midterm election where he rings every polling booth with, you know, ICE agents to check IDs to scare everyone, all the people that might not be in the country legal, make them illegal, you know. And there's all kinds of disruptions that could potentially happen there. I think this is just the reality of where we are. We've got an area of scarcity. You know, you imagine the situation with data centers. You know, I don't know how many of us have watched these AI gurus talk about, you know, the future of AI, and they're going to replace us all, and, you know, they're going to build these and they're going to do that. Well, you know, it's all part of the digital era. You know, the era in that they haven't got the materials to do it anyway. All these alternative energy things, right? Wind power, solar. No one ever checked if the bill of materials was capable of being drawn from our resource bank. Like, I know some of the world luminaries in mining, and so I talk to them regularly. And I've done heaps of research. If you look back on my, you know, return of matter and stuff like that, we need about 6 major copper mines to open per year to build out this AI vision that everyone's got and this alternative energy vision. And we're not going to build 6 a year. We'd be lucky to build 1. And so we haven't got enough copper. We haven't got enough lead. We haven't got enough silver. We haven't got enough anything. And guess what? China controls it. So if anyone's going to build it, they're going to build it. And they haven't got enough either. And so the world is kind of like in this little fantasy land where you can measurably look at the supply and go, okay, you know, it's like building a house. Do you have the materials to build a house? You count them out. You look at all the bricks and mortar and all that kind of stuff. You can work out if you build a house. They haven't done that first principle stuff for AI or green energy. And so we've got this assumption that we're going to build this thing out and it's all going to happen. But that comes from our conditioning with respect to, you know, having abundance of everything. Our conditioning is telling us that that's not a problem. It's just money and finance and policy, and that's all we have to do. It's classic EU thinking from the technocrats, is that they just decide what they're going to do. They don't even work out if it's possible. And as it turns out, it's not possible. It's not possible. And people don't believe that when I tell them. I've done some of the best work on the world in supply chains for critical minerals. And I'll give you an example, tantalum. Tantalum is going to be used by NVIDIA and AMD to build their new chips. I think it's the Rivkin chip, the Ultra Rivkin, and there's another one that's named after a mathematician. So what I did is I went down and looked at all their build reports, you know, the stuff that described, you know, the hardware that they were building, and then I did a bottom-up estimate. Now, we at the moment produce about 850 ton of tantalum per year for the whole world. And NVIDIA, by 2028, will be using about 850 ton of tantalum. That's one company. So we need to expand tantalum. And that's a rare earth for people that don't know it. It's used to isolate electricity. We have to build out tantalum supplies by 5 times, and we're just not going to do it. So all of these stuff that you hear about them building and the robots and the it's just not going to happen. It's going to hit a wall, and we're already seeing reports of that in the US market where they're canceling data centers. But people won't believe it.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly, again, to my point. You know, we abstracted so much of this away, and obviously, in a world of today, you know, where everything is so complex, a lot of people can't really cherish and really understand, you know, what's happening in the background and how much goes into building these things, you know, and the importance of the real resources and the supply chains and everything behind it. I mean, you know, I read this, I think also on your X profile, you know, and it really clicked for me because, like, Here in the Switzerland and in Germany, we talk about a lot about the active degradation of Western auto capacity, you know, automobiles. Like the Germans, they've built automobiles for years and they've been the leaders. And now everything seems to be hollowed out by the Chinese. But then I feel like that's only the symptom, you know, the German car dynasty ending. I mean, it's really that because everything is moving to China, it's, and you said it yourself as well, it's hollowing out our defense capabilities. So could you maybe talk to this a little more? Like, military power comes downstream of technology. This seems really true, but a lot of people don't appreciate this nowadays. Yeah, is there anything else you know, that you could throw
well,
in
there? They're converting all the German car factories to missile factories. The defense production, you know, there's $300 billion that's going to go into that. You know, is it Weiss or Weiss, the German Chancellor? What's his name? Weiz or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's also slipped my name, but yeah, we.
No,
we
that's
know
all right. Whoever he is is converting German factories into missile plants. They've got this thing by Palmer Luckey, he's going to be building Ford missiles. You know, they're going to be Anduril missiles built in Ford factories. You know, we're converting. You've got, you know, the Defense Production Act has been invoked for all rare earths and all production of military stuff. So you've got Chris Wright, the Energy Secretary, who no longer has to go to tender for anything. He just decides what happens. And so, you know, you've got an acceleration of this stuff that's beyond anything that we've seen in anybody's lifetime, you know, the older ones or the younger ones. So we're moving to, you know, we're moving to onshore a lot of things, but it's obviously takes longer than we think. You know, there was a Canadian copper smelter that was proposed by Glencore the other day. And Glencore just threw up their arms and said, they can't do it because the Canadian government was too difficult. The same things happen, you know, right around the world. You know, we in Australia, we closed a lithium plant that had 344 employees. You know, like the cost of opening a lithium plant versus the cost of closing one is quite different. And in our economic models that our central banks use, they just turn it off and on. And the reality is it doesn't just turn off and on. When you turn one off, all the people go and do other things. The factory falls into disrepair. You know, it probably gets torn up and scrapped and all this kind of stuff. And to turn one on costs many hundreds of millions of dollars more than turning one off. So we're not prioritizing this as far as governments go. You know, and in Europe, you've got real present danger. If China starts supplying Russia with armaments, you know, and can they be stopped by the Europeans without the Ukrainians? I think the Ukrainians are as Macron said the other day, I think the Ukrainians are the only thing standing between Europe and freedom. And so you end up, and you got little telltales like the Ukrainians turned up, 200 Ukrainians turned up in Syria and have set up any ship drone systems to shoot Russian boats in the Mediterranean. They turned up in Syria, and Zelensky got to, you know, treated like a hero. He got a grand parade and everything, and they're setting up in Syria as well. So you've got North Korea, who are test firing at 10 times the rate missiles towards Japan and South Korea, and are playing around with missile testing. And you've got China saying maybe we incorporate North Korea into China. And there's lots of little telltales around the world. You've got our industrial system isn't fit for purpose. Like, because we didn't make anything, our industrial systems are brittle. I've got a a study I did called Shock Point, where I looked at every industrial accident over the last 2 years in North America. And there were 24 major ones. And then, you know, there's fires and explosions everywhere. And it's like, you know, Biden started it with putting all this green energy funding in. And that put load on the industrial thing because it wasn't being used properly before. And then Trump has come in and, you know, typical, the allocation of budget will solve everything. Trump's come in and loaded up even more. And now, you know, you've got a place in New York State, which is a aluminium smelter that has caught fire 3 times in 4 months or 5 months. And that closed down the whole Ford factory because they couldn't get the aluminium. And so you've got all these breakages. You know, I talked about herbicide before. How do we grow crops in monocrops? And like, you know, I'm an organic farmer myself. First thing I say is, we'll grow them organically. You know, I've got 200 ton of horse manure a year from all my horses, and I can turn that into fertilizer. But you know, that's not how our monoculture industrial farming works. And so if you just take it away in 1 year or a year and a half, you end up in great difficulties. But you don't solve it by, you know, Trump could close up the whole thing and go home and leave Hormuz to itself. You don't end up with peace. You know, this the cat's out of the bag now.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to ask, you know, like the cat's out of the bag, you know, Trump's reordering has been, initiated in that sense, you know. And so, you know, my question would be, obviously, now, you know, a lot of countries, or at least the U.S., they're trying to reshore that stuff. They're trying to come up with their own industries and everything to kind of rebuild that productive capacity that is needed. I mean, that to me sounds like, yeah, the existing world order is being disrupted, which sort of means that, like the economist in me is telling me this will have downside effects, obviously, no? And then you can think about like the protectionist policies and blunt trade controls that will be coming up because of potential shortages from that disruption in all these resources and stuff. And so that will drive costs. My question is, we can't go from one system to the other without disruption. And so what is your view in that sense? Will we have to go through the valley of tears, you know, for a couple of years until we rebuild everything, and then maybe we'll come out brighter? Or what will that transition look like, you know?
Transition looks ugly. Like, you know, I put a paper together yesterday that put, you know, 500 to a billion people's food security at risk. Mm-hmm. You know, the reality is you can't pull apart. I compare it to conjoined twins trying to choke each other. You know, they don't know that they're integrated with each other, so they think they're gonna beat each other to death. And the reality is they're just gonna hurt each other. I think they just hurt each other ultimately. And you know, they hurt. The blast radius is worse for the countries adjacent and poorer than in China and America, because they've got military and they've got access to, you know, a bunch of stuff that other countries haven't. So it does look extremely difficult. I say to everyone, think about your own personal resilience. Think about, you know, if you can grow food, or you can grow food at your parents' place, or you can grow food at your grandmother's place, you know, maybe start thinking about it. Because at the end of the day, we're being conditioned to think that these kind of things don't happen. So it's quite difficult to comprehend. And, you know, there's, you know, the five stages of grief, you know, has the first one as anger, and the second one is denial and all this kind of stuff. It's better to get yourself through those stages and start looking at the world as it is rather than as we want it to be. I've got children of my own and brothers and sisters who, you know, I guess are triggered by Trump. But it doesn't help to be triggered by Trump, because I think he's a symptom rather than, you know, 3 or 4 years, he may not even be alive. You know, these are older people, all of them. But the reality of how the system is breaking is not gonna go away with personalities. That's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is the globalization's dying, and it's gonna be a painful death. You can't not make everything in each country and continue as we were, you know. You mentioned protectionism, for instance. You know, protectionism was the standard way that countries operated until about the late 70s, the mid 70s. Mm. And, you know, through, I guess, the end of history and all those kinds of ideas, we decided that we were going to, not worry about protectionism. We were going to free trade, and we're going to free trade with our rivals. Well, that's turned out to have a tail impact that's quite significant. That free trade has weakened our industrial base, and now we can't make anything, and we can't, you know, we become vassal states of China if we wish. And, you know, there may be some argument with that. It may be compatible. Some people want to do that. Or every country can be more self-reliant. Now, I go back to, you know, for instance, climate change. Climate change has got a lot worse. I spent a lot of time in COVID looking at all the IPCC models, and the IPCC models are quite naive. You know, they model things in a very coarse way. Sulfur, for instance, is something equally distant all around the world as one thin layer. And we know sulfur is burnt from coal, and we know it comes from ships, you know, burning marine diesel and things like that. And the reality is that we've missed, the models missed the acceleration of climate change that was likely to happen. And now the models are picking it up. And so you can't make a low-carbon world by getting China to make everything. You've got to build it yourself. You've got to be able to build the batteries yourself. You've got to be able to build, you know, the windmills or the solar cells yourself. You can't ship them all over the world, ship all the oil to China, get it refined in China, then ship them back. You know, the net carbon in that process is you might as well have not built the thing. You might as well just continue to build diesel. And so if you look at all the studies, solar's getting more efficient, wind's getting more efficient, but they're not getting more efficient at carbon reduction. I wish they were. And we've got other things coming at us that that we need to be concerned about. We've got like an El Nino coming next year that it looks mammoth. We've got to grow crops in it. We haven't got any fertilizer, we haven't got any herbicide, and we haven't got any all the sulfur and all the other stuff. I don't know how the hell we're going to do it. And people, you know, I grew up in a land of plenty. So did you. And, you know, so did the audience. And we haven't had to consider that there are actual constraints to our lifestyle. And now we do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it might be one of these grand scheme of things type of scenarios, you know, where you really have to rethink and plan for stuff which you would have never thought is possible in the first place. But I mean, I want to bring in this question from my friend, you know, who is a fellow Aussie, James Jack from Jack on Chain. He's one of the Bitcoin people. And he was asking about like also the role of countries like Australia, where you live yourself, or Canada, you know, what kind of setup or what kind of role they play in the setup today, you know, being potentially an important strategic resource node. And how do you think about this from the Australian perspective? Because, and even I'm interested because I know some people out of Europe who are fleeing and emigrating to Australia because they kind of still believe, okay, Australia is at the farthest end of the world, at the corner over there, and you're just isolated and safe. Yeah. Is that actually true? Or like, yeah, how do you think about Australia as well?
I got a bunch of daughter-in-laws who are one's from Paris and the other one's from South Africa. And they came here. Well, I'm sure they came here for my sons, but they also came here because they love the idea of living in Australia, and we know lots of people like that. And, you know, our immigration rate is probably the highest in the world, and we're welcoming people from all over the world. So, yes, That's true. I think Australia has, I think, 26, 27 million people, and we've got 20% of everything in the world, which is a rough way to look at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got 20% mm-hmm. of the uranium and copper and just about everything. So our per capita wealth is ridiculous. And, you know, the same goes to Canada. They've got a few more people and a few less resources, but, you know, almost the same. You know, we're going to have to become the, you know, in this resource shortage, because we want to build all this new stuff, in this resource shortage, we're going to have to become the suppliers to the world. But it's talking sense to our politicians too, because they're kind of stuck in that old frame that, you know, housing investment and all these things that we used to do is still adequate. It's not adequate. We need to become the kind of refiner and the mining pit for, you know, the whole world, so to speak. And, you know, we've still got this form of stateless capitalism as, you know, user pays. You know, the Chinese aren't doing that. You know, we need to provide the electrification to the mines. We need to do a lot of stuff at a state level, at an Australia level, that allows us to facilitate, you know, the welfare of the rest of the world. And when, you know, we've got 30 days diesel, you know, we've got the worst diesel supplies in the world, and we've got some of the highest fossil fuel resources in the world. It doesn't make any sense. And it's because a lot of these technocrats have decided that, you know, that they're kind of isolated technocrats. They often live in nice houses and have, you know, funky jobs and all that kind of stuff. And they decide policy for us, and they haven't been very practical over the last 20, 30 years. And we need to get really, really practical. You know, we haven't got enough urea. We haven't got enough fertilizer either. Our Prime Minister came on television and said, I've secured 25% of Australia's fertilizer for the year. And it's like, 25%? You know, where's the rest going to come from? And we're going to be hit by all this El Nino that wipes out a lot of crops due to drought anyway, because, you know, that's somewhat forecastable, because we know what's happened in every other scenario. And so we have a lot of work to do, and that's what I suggest to everybody, is stop moralizing at each other, to stop judging each other as to having lesser morals. There's work to be done in order to ensure our welfare. And it's better to focus on that than, you know, what they call it, Trump derangement syndrome and all that kind of stuff. He'll be long gone. And people like you and your age group will have to carry, will be shouldering the burden of all
this. The burden,
this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, exactly. That's why, I love talking to people like you, you know, who can really share this perspective and try to help us empathetically understand what's happening without really judging and moralizing about it. But yeah, I mean, you've already somewhat painted a picture, but like, if you had to paint a picture of how things will unravel from here, you know, it's end of April almost, like, yeah, where are we going in the next 6 months? Obviously, it's hard to make any predictions, but like, how do you think about the state of things and what's to come?
Well, this is just, you know, what I think at the moment. I might change my mind tomorrow depending on events, because I think that's an important thing to hold. Is there's, you know, everybody in the world wants to predict what's going to happen, and almost nobody in the world has accurately predicted it. So making predictions is nonsense, really. I don't think Trump can back off. I don't think Trump can back off in Iran. I think he's got an aircraft carrier that's 3 days away. I think, you know, I think it's the Bush or something like that. I think they have to control Hormuz because of the Chinese energy situation. I don't think they can allow Iran to do it. And I think they'll do what they have. And you've got UAE, Bahrain, Saudi, all the other states around it. Like, you know, the indigenous Arabs are basically saying they don't want the Iranians either. So it's not as if Trump's out on his own. And you've got I have a big property in Metro Sydney that's got a big forest on it. But one end of the forest, I've got an Iranian mosque. So I know them fairly well. And, you know, isn't it? Even the Iranians don't even want the Iranians in the current mullahs in power. So I think that has to be resolved, and I don't think it's going to be easy, and I don't think it's going to be straightforward. And but I don't think Trump's going to back off. If you look at his personality, weird as it probably is, you know, he managed not to flinch right through some pretty horrendous political attacks, and he just didn't seem to notice. You know, he's not somebody that backs down, and I don't think he's going to take a loss. I think he's going to have to be defeated, and I think it's going to be hard to defeat the Americans. But, you know, then roll forward a month or two or something like that. I hope it's not dystopian like this. I hope they solve it all next week and we all forget about it. You know, I think we run into crop failures. You know, I think the reality is, you know, we also run into mining. Like, you know, if it's not constrained enough, you know, the first process for much of the rare earths is to do with sulfur, and you got 50% of it all caught up in Hormuz. Now, sulfuric acid is used in the leaching process at the first stage of most rare earths mines. So, you know, when they're concentrating the ore to send to the refinery, usually in China, they use a lot of sulfuric acid. Now, a lot of them won't be able to get the sulfuric acid they need to do it. So you end up with price spikes in copper, uranium, rare earths, fertilizer. You know, India's paying twice as much for the fertilizer than they were paying 6 months ago. You know, there's people flying with freight planes fertilizer out of because they can't get around the Hormuz. So I think you end up, as you know, 2026 is a tough year. And we should all just shoulder that. Like, at the end of the day, it is what it is. And, you know, I think we've got all kinds of challenges to go. You know, I don't think Trump's finished. You know, Secretary Hegseth talked about taking Greenland a week ago. I thought it was all over, and then he raised it again, you know. And that comes back to, you know, Panama, all those kind of things. I don't think they care anymore what people think. I think they're just going to go and do what they think they need to do. And whether that's the right thing or wrong thing, I'll let the historians decide, because I can't decide from here. I don't know what was going to happen and what they were trying to avoid. And we're in a, you know, there's a hierarchy of intelligence, isn't there? You know, we're at the lowest hierarchy. We read a lot, but we're probably just above the normal people. But do we really know what's going on? I don't think any of us do we?
No, that's exactly right. Yeah, but we try to at least get some bits and pieces into better understanding. You definitely helped us, and you helped me and the audience. But maybe I'll want to bring this to a close, you know, and ask this one last question. And you were already saying, you know, maybe think about more serious things like growing your own crops, which might be the most important thing to do right now. But then, you know, if I bring in this last question, how should investors navigate the current markets? You know, like if you have a portfolio and you're managing money, like how do you think about this? Should you now double down on all these resources? Sorry?
Get out of AI. Get out of technology. We're way overvalued. There's a rotation on into all these things that we're talking about. I think there's $400 trillion invested in the US market in financials and AI and all those kind of things, non-industrials, and about 1% of it's industrials and mining, or maybe 2% or something like that. There naturally has to be a rotation into that stuff. And so, you know, like these AI companies, like Dorio from Anthropic didn't even have coding on his business plan till 14 months ago, and now coding is central to his business plan. These guys are floating around building stuff, looking for a solution. And, you know, they're going to replace us all at one stage, and then, you know, they're not going to do that. Humans are the tent poles that hold the thing up. You know, but maybe eventually, in another 10 years, then maybe they will do that. But they're not going to do it quickly, because they can't build the data centers anyway. They can't build the copper. So get out of those things. And you've got to be really precise because you just can't get into minerals either because of those things I mentioned. If you invest in a rare earth company that needs sulfuric acid, you're not going to be able to mine anything. Linus Metals, for instance, a big rare earth company, haven't got any sulfuric acid, although they might run out. So that's going to devalue them. The Mag 7 are, say, 40% of the S&P, aren't they, or something like that? Yeah. So I personally look at innovators because I think we are going to bring all this critical metals and materials on, and we're going to innovate. And there's a whole class of company that are going to do that better. And I'll give you an example. Next to every coal-fired power station in the world, including Europe, there's a thing called coal ash. Some places they call it fly ash. And they call it fly ash because it's really light. It's really fine-grained. Now, in every, I'll give one example. In every ton of fly ash, there's 7 kilos of titanium. There's about 500 grams of gold. I'd have to look up my numbers, but they're significant. The Department of Energy in the US have put out a tender for fly ash technology that will transform fly ash into rare earths and titanium and things like that. So you end up with a circular economy. Like if all that stuff's lying around, it's free. That kind of innovation is going to take off. That's the new Zuckerbergs of the next era. There's a company called Operion X who are going to make titanium powder out of scrap. And if you know anything about titanium, they have to get something that big, and they've got to reduce it to something that big to make what they want. Now, if you can make it out of powder and you can 3D print titanium, that saves a lot of titanium and ends up 80% cheaper. There's companies that are going to do rare earth refining. And, rather than doing it in huge football field-sized ponds that cause lots of pollution, they're going to do what they call closed loop. So it looks like a big plumbing convention. It's just, floor after floor of plumbing, it looks like. But there's no pollution. So there's companies like that right through our economies. There's a company called Elementos. That's it in the European sector, and they're mining tin in Spain, and they've got a smelter, so they don't have to send it anywhere. You've got another company, Vulcan Energy, Australian company. Who in Germany are going to, they're going to take brine from near the German automakers and pump it up, make thermal power out of it, and turn and extract the lithium and then pump it back down again. So you've got this wave of innovation that's going to come across right across the world that's going to save us eventually. It's just that, when I was a kid, I swam out to some girls in a huge lake who were sailing, who had capsized, and I realized because it was a very cold lake, I shouldn't have tried to make the swim because it was about 3 kilometers. And so the last kilometer, to me just trying to talk to these young girls, was very, very hard. I wasn't sure I was going to make it because, you're from Switzerland, you know what swimming in cold lakes like, fresh water.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And that's what it's going to be like for us. To get to the boat, we're going to have to swim hard and long and endure lots of pain, lots of unemployment, lots of shortages. You go back 1,000 generations, every one of those generations did it easier than us. Do you know what I mean? Like we've got the stock to go through it. Your ancestors, 1,000 generations back, survived, and so we've got the ability to survive too. We just have to change our mental framework, and go out in nature and enjoy ourselves along the way, because we've become better people, by the way, while we're doing it.
I mean, that's something I would ascribe to as well, or that's obvious for me. If you go back, it's something we lost, you know, connect to nature. And I mean, I just feel it every day in my life. If I just go for a stroll and let my mind sort of wander, that's very, very critical and important. But I mean, now you got me curious. You know, I want to ask this one last question. We understood the critical importance of critical minerals and metals, but what about our digital commodity? You know, obviously referring to Bitcoin, like, is there any, does it have any role to play in that world as well? Or how do you think about Bitcoin?
I think it's going to be used by the Americans to their advantage. You know, you're on the stable coin in particular, you know, they've connected it to USTs, US Treasuries, so that somebody in Botswana or Nigeria or wherever can hold US cash offshore. And if you're in Nigeria, that's a huge advantage. If you're in Somalia, that's a huge advantage. No one can take it off you. I think that part of the Bitcoin story, and I think that goes for BTC and you know, some of the others, maybe not all the others. I don't think we live in the world that we contemplated Bitcoin being, you know, as successful as we thought it was going to be. I think that's kind of nuanced now. But I think the Americans are right behind the digital coin stuff. I'm not sure it'll come out the way you want it to, in the sense of, you know, freedom and the opaqueness and the ability to transact without, you know, observation. I think that, you know, big government, you know, gets to that somehow. But you know, you've got to, and also in an all-out war, you know, the Russians have been castigated by the UK Prime Minister for floating their submarines over the telecommunication cables. You know, it doesn't take a ship to pull your submarine cables out of the water and cut them. And also, it's, you know, dependent on energy. It doesn't mean you lose your Bitcoin. It might mean you lose access. So, you know, I'd say diversify. You know, like, you know, I'm completely off grid here, and I live in the middle of Sydney, and I've got my own old growth forest, and I've got, you know, a secret garden with lots of vegetables and all kinds of things. You know, and I'm, you know, I've got solar cells and all that kind of thing. I think everyone has to think about that kind of thing, because, you know, that's we've got to go back to what our ancestors did. And I think BTC plays a part. I think stable coins plays a part, but dystopia is dystopia. Nothing gets you through with a golden ticket.
Yeah. No, but the keyword diversification, that's exactly right for me. But then that's where you said, you know, you said yourself, you know, Bitcoin for me plays a part there as well. Like, thinking about taking more self-responsibility, trying to be self-sovereign. I mean, given that, and that's what I assume, Bitcoin is this very decentralized protocol, you know, that won't be able to be taken down anytime soon. Then you kind of have an option to, besides the crops that you grow your own, the gold that you keep somewhere in a vault hidden in your garden, you also have a Bitcoin 24 word seed phrase, you know, that you're hide away just in case. And so that kind of adds up for me in that sense. But yeah, Craig, thanks a lot for doing this. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, just the whole thing is flexibility. You know, one of the things that Soros, the investor, not Soros, the political operative, but the investor was a genius. Soros said, always identify your mistakes before anyone else does. And I think that's a great bit of advice, is you're open to your own wrongness, your own error, and you're constantly questioning it yourself. Because I think, you know, Bitcoin, I think, plays a part, but, you know, I worry about some of the hodls that make it the whole thing. You know what I mean? Like, it has to sit in a diversified portfolio.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's, I mean, Yeah, I'm a Bitcoiner through and through, but I mean, as more as I understand the world, you know, with all these intricacies and uncertainties, I mean, Bitcoin is not this panacea that solves all the world's problems, and not mine either. And so I have to diversify, but I want to be open to everything again, you know, because that's also how you kind of navigate this world of today, I guess.
You can't solve all the problems us boomers created with Bitcoin. That's what I'm basically saying. That they're long invested problems that we've created for the next generation. So, you know, I apologize.
Maybe it's one tool that we can use, but one of many. And so, thanks a lot for keeping up with us and telling, giving us all these insights. I hope we can do it in the future again. And greetings to Australia. It's been a long way until they get there, I guess. But yeah, thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right, man. Take care.
Thank you very much. Yes, you too. Thank you.